Right, this is Talking with Bill Erickson on August 17th, 1975, at Clark Lake Radio Observatory, Borrego Springs, California. Okay, what was your degree in?
Well, let's see, I was always kind of interested in astronomy. I always wanted to do astronomy, but went to school pretty shortly after the war. And in those days, you know, jobs and money were really quite available.
Right.
Especially in physics. And I went to Minnesota, grew up in northern Minnesota, went to the University of Minnesota, and really had intended to go someplace else for graduate work and do astronomy, because particularly then the astronomy department at Minnesota wasn't very good. It was just one man, William Lighton. I'd worked for him for years doing...
As an undergraduate?
Yeah, yeah. Working on his proper motions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why my glasses are so thick. I was kind of along with old Lighton, but didn't particularly want to study. He's kind of cranky old Dutch.
Right.
So I took a bachelor's degree, essentially in physics, although it ended up in mathematics. Just for a strange happenstance, they needed a teaching assistant in physics. The department chairman called me in and asked me if, even though I was an undergraduate, I could work as a teaching assistant for him. Said he didn't know how he could clear it with the university. I said, well, it's no problem. I've already completed a math major. I could graduate next week.
This was a
week before graduation. So I could graduate next week and call myself a graduate student for the last semester of physics. And so I went trotting over to the math department and graduated and went right back to physics again.
So where did you finally end up?
Well, then I got sort of... trouble is, I just... it sort of swaggled into it because I just was a teaching assistant for a semester and kind of got into some research work and things like that. So I decided to stay at Minnesota for another year. And after I'd been there for another year, I then started finding I'd lose so much time trying to transfer that I stayed on and ended up taking a PhD in physics at Minnesota.
And what was your thesis topic?
Actually, largely radio astronomy.
Oh, really?
I worried primarily about mechanisms of radio noise origin. I'd gotten an NSF postdoctoral fellowship, pre-doctor, I should say. I was doing mostly mass spectroscopy with Al Neer there, and geological age determinations and so forth. And I decided that I'd learned about as much as I was going to learn about mass spectroscopy and the techniques of making very well stabilized power supplies and electron beams and all this sort of stuff. And I got this pre-doctoral fellowship, so I was sort of financially independent of a research assistantship or teaching assistantship. Kind of looked around, and since I'd been interested in astronomy all along, I just started doing some thinking about radio wave generation and did a theoretical thesis, sort of little known thesis.
Now, when did you finally get your degree? What year?
In 1956.
In 56? You started off post-war, just after the war, beginning your undergraduate.
48 I started.
Oh, okay. So that's 8 years total for the whole thing. Yeah. And was this ever published anywhere, the main results of this?
There's an old astrophysical journal article.
Have to check that out.
What I was doing largely was just comparing various schemes of... this was in the days really before synchrotron emission was accepted.
Right. The Russians were accepting it.
Yeah, the Russians were accepting it and other people were sort of thinking about it. And largely a comparison of various and sundry schemes of radio noise origin.
And what did you conclude?
Nope. Well, concluded that synchrotron emission was a pretty good scheme. Also, proposed one that has never really worked out very well. It's always kind of stuck around the background, and that is the amusing thing that if you have gases running into each other, the interstellar grains, just by equal partition of energy, rotate at radio wavelengths. So if you could dream up any way of getting a dipole on them,
right,
you can
a few kilohertz. Generate. A few kilohertz in
megahertz.
Even that high?
Yeah. Right. And it doesn't seem to work out with just quadrupole moments. You really need some way of getting a dipole, otherwise you don't get enough radiation off the things. Yeah. Did some playing with that mechanism, of course, the usual free mechanisms, and plasma radiation, and so forth. Did some work on synchrotron emission.
What is your opinion about the more or less controversy of that time? Do you think the Russians were just... they have good reason to be accepting it so heartily, or was it just because it was their own theory and then they were pushing it just like everyone was pushing their own theory? Did they have more insight, do you think, or they were just...
I think so. Shlosky is a very bright guy. And, I don't know. You know, the Russians seem to oftentimes kind of accept things a little, maybe without too much, you know, kind of uncritically.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, probably was their own theory and they're pushing it. But, well, of course, as soon as the polarization on the crab came
the around, optical
was... That was right. Very strong evidence in favor of it.
But still, it's been my impression that in the West, that was 54 or 55, and then still in 56, it really... when was it? I mean, was it the radio polarization of the crab that really clinched it for most Western...
Yeah, I think so. And then polarization measurements on other sources, too. That's probably the main thing that clinched it, along with just the fact that, you know, as you looked at other mechanisms, at least from my point of view, early on, that, you know, synchrotron radiation seemed pretty preposterous. It seemed as though you ought to try other things that would seem more reasonable than having MEV and BEV electrons. Big, large numbers around. You know.
Right.
We all knew the universe was just a cool thing. It didn't really have, except for cosmic rays, it never really didn't have much of a handle on those things. I was in graduate school, used to sort of joke with Minnesota was quite strong in cosmic rays, and I used to joke with a lot of the other guys, you know, saying that if cosmic rays turned off tomorrow, you know, and in 50 years, everyone would say it was all just experimental errors.
No, but still, even though people had the optical polarization, the crab was their argument more or less, well, that's just one source, and we still don't know really what all these extra
galactic... There are other ways of generating optical polarization, too. Bremsstrahlung can be optical. Can be polarized if you have systematic motions,
right.
Say of a gas cloud,
or of course reflection off dust.
Yeah. But there's a number of ways of getting optical polarization as well, and I think it is more just that you couldn't find any other decent mechanism.
Yeah. It was at least preposterous.
But gradually people got less preposterous than most of the other mechanisms. The sort of standard things, free emission and so forth and so on, seem more reasonable, you know, right off, but then when you look at them in some detail, they get just more and more and more difficult. And of course, in those days, we didn't have much of an idea of densities or masses or even velocities to a large extent. And, you know, as those numbers kind of came along and got more and more accepted, then the other mechanisms pretty much just got more and more difficult. Pretty soon, synchrotron emission is about the only thing that seemed able to do it.
So, what did you do after you got your degree then?
Then I went to Carnegie Institution, DTM, in Washington.
Right.
And
what was going on when you got there?
Well, let's see. I went there for an interview the day that Ken Franklin and Bernie Burke found Jupiter.
Oh, really?
I was there interviewing for a job when
they were getting out the ephemeris and...
I think it was Bernie actually suggested to Ken that he should have a look at where Jupiter was. They looked for Saturn or something like that.
Yeah.
Ken came in, say, it fits with Jupiter.
So that looked like a pretty exciting place to be at that time.
And of course, Merle too was a real live wire.
I've interviewed him.
Yeah, right. I called him to get you an appointment with him.
Oh, that's right.
Do well by you?
Oh, very, very. Yeah. We got into many different areas besides radio astronomy.
He's a very interesting fellow. Let's see. The staff members there, I just went there on a postdoc fellowship, but the staff members were Bernie and John Feuerer and Howard Tatel and Merle Tuve, who were essentially the four that were doing radio astronomy. And of course, there were geophysicists, George Weatherall, and some nuclear physicists.
Yeah.
Dean Cowling and so forth. And some biophysicists and all that sort of thing. But, those four were the radio astronomers. And Larry Helfer was there as a postdoc just before me. And we overlapped for a year, two-year usual postdocs.
And so what did you work on? What was your interest in going there?
Well, I just did lots of different things, and I hadn't done any observational work at all until then. Although I'd done some experimental work, and then done essentially theoretical thesis. So I was somewhat just wanting to learn something about observational techniques. And John Feuerer and I did some solar observations, looking at polarization, solar bursts. This out at the Durwood Labs. The other guy that was at DTM, people always tend to forget him, was Harry Wells. I don't know if you ever ran into him.
No, but I remember you mentioning him to me before, and I took note of his address. He's somewhere in Virginia, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen him around in years and years.
Was he an engineer there?
No, he's an astronomer. I'm sure he was on the staff. Astronomer. He was trying to make absolute intensity measurements on radio sources. But seemed always to have crummy equipment and crummy techniques, and it seemed to get it quite right. He went to Jodrell Bank, and he and Lubbock made some absolute measurements. It seemed to be somewhat better. There's some Lubbock and Wells observations from way back then. And then he went to work with the State Department as a scientific attaché here and there, and retired eventually. He was a big knocker in Ursi in those days. I think he was international chairman for one period. Certainly the national chairman. He was mainly a committee. So kind of like John Hagen these days.
Yeah.
Have you talked with John?
No, he's on my list. Though.
I see. Yeah. Get him. He's just retiring now.
Definitely want to get him. So what were you able to establish with these solar observations? What was the main thrust?
Oh, well, as I say, this was mainly just measurements on polarization. The main establishment was that, at least on the bandwidths that I was able to use, there was no linear polarization observable, strong circular polarization, variable circular polarization. Some dependence upon the direction of circularity with the position of the of sunspot group and so forth. And then John Feuerer was building this about 320 megahertz solar array out at River Road, just a line of one-dimensional array of helical antennas. And I spent quite a bit of time helping John designing and building that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he and Bernie got up this project, what they called the PPEA, Precise Position Apparatus, for making accurate position measurements on radio sources. It was just two long corner reflectors run as an interferometer. And this was just about the time that Owens Valley, Bolton and Stanley were proposing the 290-foot dishes and so forth. And the Carnegie people were maybe a few months ahead in the way of starting a project, an interferometer project, to try to make accurate source positions. The idea being then to get that optical identifications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's only about five identified radio sources in the United States. And so probably most of the time that I was there, I spent working on that apparatus.
Cambridge wasn't concerning itself anymore? I mean, you know, Graham Smith, of course, got those first few, then Nabel, mm-hmm. Cygnus, and Cass, and a few mm-hmm. others, but in this period, they didn't follow it up, really?
That was in the days of the infamous 2C catalog.
Right. They were just concerned with cataloging, maybe.
Yeah, they were cataloging a lot of sources, and I think they were starting to have doubts as to the reliability of their whole catalog and so forth. I think they were just sort of all wound up with the problems with the 2C catalog and what was going on.
They were
on.
Preoccupied with that, yeah.
Just weren't really doing very much on it. And of course, Mills, it must be. Mills Cross was.
He was taking his observations at this time.
In operation then.
Because his paper was published on.
That is not such very. I mean, that was what, 50 or so minutes of arc beamlet?
Something like that, right.
And 80 megahertz with a lot of atmospheric refraction. So you probably, at least our theory or our idea was you probably couldn't trust those positions mm-hmm. better than 5 or 10 minutes of arc.
Mm-hmm.
And realized that you needed 1 minute of arc sorts of positions in order to do good optical identification.
Right. And so how are you going to get that?
Well, this, to begin with, what the idea was to have these long corner reflectors and do a radio source survey, essentially with very accurate phase measurements to get one-dimensional
right.
accurate positions, and just pick the whole thing up and put it in a little different azimuth and do it again, and then pick it up and do it a third time.
Hmm.
That was the idea of it.
Why would you have to do a survey first? You apparently didn't trust.
Well, I mean,
available.
In other words, do maybe 100 sources or 150 sources.
Get precise positions for them.
Get precise positions in one dimension for those, and then pick the thing up and move it.
Okay, I see.
And obviously, you weren't going to do one source, move it. Do it again.
No, I thought you were first going to find the sources, but you were taking known sources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
More or less known sources. And,
but you weren't directly involved in that yourself.
Not directly, although spent quite a bit of time helping. As I say, kind of a learning process, learning techniques and helping with these different things.
So
I was sort of the junior member of the three of us, Bernie and John and I, were primarily concerned.
I suppose that Bernie mentioned this when I interviewed him. I can't remember for sure, but. Did anything ever come out of this, or?
No, nothing ever came out of that.
It never got built, or?
It got built. About the time that I was leaving Carnegie, finishing my fellowship, John was offered this job was director of High Altitude Observatory. And so John left. And Bernie got interested in something else. And I left. And that's about where
I'm an orphan.
That's about where I. And I think besides that, the handwriting was on the wall. But I mean, Bolton and Stanley had gotten their money and were going ahead.
Right.
And really, that's one of the problems at Carnegie is oftentimes early into things, but sort of with too little, you know, not
right.
enough money to really...
Doesn't quite have the critical mass to...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then in about the last 6 months that I was there...
This is 58 then?
Well, let's see, I was actually there, it must have been only about 18 months, rather than a full 2 years. I went in March or April of 56, and went out to Convair in the fall of 57. So,
okay.
After I'd been there maybe a year or so, something like the last 6 months, I decided I'd like to learn something about hydrogen line work. And went and worked with Howard Tatel on that was the Würzburg antenna on the early 50-channel, 55-channel correlator. They had Howard just gotten the correlator running, the multi-channel receiver running.
Oh, no, this was an autocorrelator?
No, I'm sorry. Correlator. The
filter bank.
Filter bank.
Okay,
I didn't see that. Before Sandy Wine Ribbon.
Well, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
Right, I just
misspoke. Misspoke yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, so that...
So, like, as I say, and, you know, there's been quite a bit of work done down near the plane. So, I started just doing a survey of higher galactic latitude hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly. Let's see, Larry Helfer had done 20 degrees. B equals 20 degrees, plus and minus 20 degrees before he left. So he was sort of interested in it. And I guess he must have come back occasionally. Because I didn't get into it until after he'd left. Then I started doing the higher latitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of got together on it. And that's where a couple of papers.
Right.
For an Erickson and Tatel. Actually, Howard had just built the system, and then he was getting ill, and he died shortly after that. And after I was at Thunder, I came back for a month or two of more of observations to finish up the survey.
What year did Tatel die in?
Must have been late 57 or early 58.
And
because I know they called me up so I wanted to know if I'd like a staff position there. You know, and I just got sort of settled in California.
Here.
I just bought a house week or so earlier. And that was awfully tempting because Carnegie is a real nice place. And much, in many ways, an awful lot nicer than Convair deal. But on the other hand, you know, just having gotten settled, I just needed to dig up and turn around.
What was your motivation for this high latitude study? Just because no one had looked with reasonable sensitivity?
Right. There was this
I guess no one had looked at all, period.
Essentially. Kerr and... What is it? Vinton? What is it? Frank and... Windemann or something. Windham. No,
that was the...
Some name almost like that. They'd done a very early high latitude survey from the sun, in the southern hemisphere at a very widely spaced grid of points.
Mm-hmm.
With a single channel receiver, every point was a day's work. and we could just do it with a much denser grid of points. Yeah, basically nobody had ever looked, so. Away from the plane, that is.
But you, if I remember correctly, you didn't play around with models of what this might be?
Not too much.
This sort of thing?
Not very much. We did find that, that there seemed to be some systematic, slight systematic motion of gas towards the plane and so forth. And so we mentioned it.
Never occurred to you to try to look at high velocities. Would you have had enough sensitivity to pick up the...
Yeah, it occurred to us, but as a matter of fact, the Dutch were, Seeger and so forth, were saying that they thought there were some bumps up there. I just didn't believe it. We tried looking at some of the real high velocities.
Right.
You know, awfully hard to tell a slow wiggle in the baseline from the...
What was sort of the lowest and brightest temperature you could reliably detect?
A degree or two.
Yeah, that's just about what they are.
Yeah.
But of course, they weren't...
Let's see, it was a 1,000-degree system, roughly. And then, we had some problems that were actually fixed after that, after I left. When the tube was wanting to look more at high velocity clouds. In those days, the way the thing was built, the local oscillator was down on the ground and we piped the signal up to the feed.
I see.
And the mixer up to feed. And that long line always had standing waves on it, which always caused baseline
ripples,
wobbles and things. Never reproduced all that well, and we were never very. Couldn't really say we didn't see the high velocity clouds.
Right, but now the high velocity clouds really weren't established until 62 or something like that, is my impression.
They were talking about them.
But they were talking about them even earlier.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to catch Seeger's going to be at this meeting.
Yeah, right, I noticed that.
I want to get him.
Yeah, it just, we just couldn't believe it. Aside from all the baseline wandering we had in that system.
Right.
It got fixed quite a bit when they moved the local oscillator up to the feed and got rid of that long transmission line.
Hmm. Okay, so now you went to Convair, which seems to me sort of a strange thing. Was Convair doing astronomy then, or?
No. I'd had a whole series of advisors in graduate school. Matter of fact, before I got my degree, I was told out near the chairman they ought to give me a degree while they still had a faculty. The one that took me on as an advisee either had a heart attack or left the faculty or went to Europe for a couple of years. I had a succession of 5 advisors.
Wow.
Doing my thesis. Each one I'd get to leave for some reason or another. One of them was Charlie Critchfield, heard about Critchfield, gamma Critchfield selection rules and beta decay and things of that sort.
Yeah.
He was a well-known physicist at that time. He's the director for theoretical physics at Los Alamos, now has been at Los Alamos for 10 or 15 years. Quite active in the early days of bomb development and all that kind of stuff, nuclear physics. But also a bit interested in astrophysics. Ian Kamoff wrote a book on, what is it called? Sort of a strange name. Something, astrophysics and nuclear energy sources or something like that. That was kind of reasonably standard textbook back in those days, before the Burbages and so forth, in understanding structure of stars. This wasn't radio stars, this was in stellar structure
Burbage, Fowler and Fowler.
All that kind of stuff.
So he was at Convair.
He was one of my advisors, and he went to Convair as a director of their research lab there, and sort of convinced me to come out. Also, I had a couple other friends that I been very close to in graduate work. Matter of fact, you remind me very much of one a mathematician friend that I had who went through graduate school with. He looked very much like you, especially since you grew up here. many of his mannerisms are the same. Gene was out there, Convery. He was always much more of a renegade than I was, so I figured if he could put up with industry, I certainly could.
This was in San Diego?
Yes.
And what were you doing?
Well, it was called Convair Scientific Research Lab, and it was privately funded by Convair. We, in general, weren't allowed to take government money. For the most part, we just had to operate off company funds. And so we could essentially do anything we wanted.
Oh, I see. Yeah, but pretty free handle.
But we couldn't spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
It sounded like a pretty good deal. The reason for its establishment, basically, was that in those days, defense contractors could write off a certain fraction of a hardware contract for basic scientific research. I forget what it was, a couple of tenths of 1% or something like that. They could write off. If they had a research lab, they could write off the cost of it.
Right.
And so, because the government was in the final stage actually paying for the research work anyway, we were legally not allowed to go out and get outside funding and so forth.
So is this why all these research lab, Boeing and so forth,
that's
were established?
I
never knew that.
Some years later, the Defense Department changed its rule on that, and companies had to either pay for them out of their own money or let them go.
Put up or shut up.
At least then these places generally disappeared.
So what did you work on?
Well, that's when I established the thing out here. I went out there and, as I say, went back to Carnegie to do some hydrogen line stuff. And we really had absolute, complete freedom to just do any damn thing we please. I mean, there was no restrictions at all on what sort of research work we could do. The theory was that it would be good for the corporation to have a few scientists around just to act as resident consultants and so forth. That was true in theory. It never worked out in practice. It turns out in practice that although, you know, we're given clearances and asked to sort of, you know, understand the details of how the Atlas missile was put together and how all these things worked and so forth and be available for consulting, we did this, but in an institution like Convair, where there's an awful lot of people who don't know what they're doing, they're always a little bit afraid of having in-house consulting, because if somebody comes along and shows them they're really being stupid and the whole thing is a boondoggle, it's likely to get around a bit more than if they call in somebody to come in from Yale and spend 2 days consulting and go back to the East Coast.
Right,
you know, it's
right.
A lot safer. In general, we just aren't called upon very much for consulting work. As a matter of fact, a couple of times I had friends that, you know, that would be called up by somebody in one of the divisions of the company to ask him if he'd come and consult me. He'd say, well, you know, that's not my field. That's Bill Erickson's
right.
Why don't you talk to him? He's the one that knows about this stuff.
But anyway, this gave you more time to work on your pet project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As so, I say, I was just looking for something that I could do that would seem interesting. With limited amount of money.
You thought of low frequency because it tends to be cheaper.
And, yeah, right.
And you'd had that experience at Carnegie.
I'd had some experience at Carnegie with this sort of thing. And it looked like the sort of stuff that I could do sort of by myself and with one technician and a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in those days, I think Well, aside from my salary and my technician's salary, we ran for years out here. We budgeted $10,000 or $15,000 a year.
Mm.
It's sort of level of funding. I think I went up to $20,000 one year and felt really flush.
Wow. So the first thing, I guess, was to find this site.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted it reasonably near San Diego and
right.
And protected.
And, I went around. Well, first just examined topographic maps for the area. And looked around the various sites and just, got in the car and went driving around various places. And I was rather tempted by a big flat area. You'll drive through it in an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
Up there by Lake Kenshaw, just down from Palomar Mountain. It's kind of a large flat area that is the edge of Lake Kenshaw. And that was very tempting. The next valley down this way to the southwest of here, the Earthquake Valley, has some pretty good sites in it. As a matter of fact, Earthquake Valley was almost where John Bolton and Gordon Stanley went when they went to Bowens Valley.
Hmm.
For a while, they were more interested in Earthquake Valley than Bowens Valley.
Did you consult with them on their site?
Oh, sure, sure. We talked about it considerably. As a matter of fact, they made quite a few interference measurements and things like that. I think they were somewhat afraid of earthquakes. And then there was this thing, I guess you were mentioning, about the water being robbed from Owens Valley. It turned out that large parts of Owens Valley were sort of really nicely available because the city of Los Angeles was taking all the water away from it.
Right.
And the farming was going to have to stop.
Right.
And they could get very cheaply. I think they had a 99-year lease.
Hmm.
On the site there quite cheaply, because it was one of the few things they could do with the area was radio telescopes on it. And when I first saw it, quite late, it seemed like kind of an ideal place for spreading out the rays. It's a lot larger than any of these others, about the closest thing to San Diego, which was really what I felt large enough. So east land started.
So what did
stringing
you,
up antennas.
So what did you first build out here? This is now in 58 or
a little bit? About that. I built this 26 megahertz array. First thing. It was a dipole array. Probably. Maybe this thing, I think I do have an old reprint here.
So this first array you built is described in IEEE AP in 65, actually published. And I guess you worked on it for several years.
Yeah. Now I sort of got it pretty well put together in 1960, to a large extent. Max Komisarov, as a matter of fact, came over for a few months. He and I worked together on the thing. We're testing and feeling our way. Making sure what works, what doesn't work. A lot of the things that go on this sort of work is that you have to develop your own techniques and sort of develop your own methods as you're going along. Develop your own test equipment. And
right.
Find what sort of material will stand up in the sun and wind and what won't. Replace the 500 things that all fall apart in the sun and wind.
Right.
Things of that nature.
It's not straightforward, yeah.
Yeah, well, largely there just isn't a whole body of well-established techniques. In building dish-type telescopes, really one falls back on a lot of technology that was developed
for radar.
100 dishes along the dew line and all this sort of thing.
Right.
There's a whole body of technology there that just doesn't exist for a lot of this kind of thing. You just have to develop.
I suppose maybe it is more now with the Navy's low frequency communication stuff. You think?
Yeah.
But that's still not as extensive as radar dishes or anything like that.
And I don't know. A lot of that course, a lot of that sort of thing also, they build things very expensively by radio.
It's not transferable, yeah.
And it's not so easy to transfer. But, anyway, really got the thing going pretty well about the time that the research lab there pretty well collapsed.
Which was?
Oh, about 61.
What was your main goal to do with this array? To use it for?
Primarily to use it for radio source work. Fluxes and positions on radio sources. Although, I used it along the line for studying the sun and looking at occultations of the Crab Nebula by the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at propagation through the corona and various and sundry other things. At the same time. Well, they treated us pretty well, really, at this lab. I never had any particular complaints with Gunbear, other than the fact that they just had the most horrendous red tape that you ever saw in your life. If you think the university is bad, the government is worse, and if you think the government is bad, you ought to try private defense contractors. They just take all the government red tape and put on top of it all the industrial red tape. It's astonishing, these stupid things. I mean, just trying to get your own textbook. Think textbooks that you own yourself in and out of the gate, you know. And take, you know, half an hour of work when you're going to go home. If you want to take a briefcase full of books home, you know, getting all the passes authorized and all this crap.
Yeah.
Just take a book home with you at night. Or a slide rule. Getting a slide rule. Practically took a congressional act. And so we didn't teach, but I always felt that life around the university was quite a bit better, because at least the thing that you spent your time on other than research was
seemed to be worthwhile,
productive than just fighting stupid red tape. Which is what I think we spent about the same amount of time at Conway fighting the stupid red tape as we do teaching in a university. At any rate, authorization to charge off the expenses of these labs was changed, and so the companies sort of either had to, as they say, put up or shut up. And well, they told us that, you know, that in about 6 months or so, the character of the lab is going to have to change, and we're just going to have to go out and get our own funding. The company couldn't afford to support us. Convair was really going in the hole those days anyway, because of this 880 and 990 jetliner project that they lost millions and millions, lost something like $750 million on that project. And so those company funds were badly off. As a matter of fact, we worked out that in all of General Dynamics at that point, our research lab was the thing that they should keep, because we were losing less money per professional person than anyone else in the company. Somehow they didn't buy this. Being a valid argument for keeping us and throwing out everyone else.